Welcome to another episode of the Middle West Podcast. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you all. I'm your host, Taqib Musa, and I'm joined on our second coronavirus episode by three guests, all of whom are frontline workers in the NHS. So first we have from London, Mustafa, who's a pharmacist, community pharmacist, working on the front lines. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
We also have a doctor, an anaesthetist, from the Midlands. So, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
And last but definitely not least, we have from up north in Manchester, we have Kamal Khan, who's a nurse, and he manages the nursing department in the ICU. So he's been working on the ground right in the face of kind of where the patients are coming in, and that's Kamal Khan. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So really appreciate all of you guys joining in, and of course, really appreciate what you guys are doing. I'm sitting at home, comfortably working from home, and chilling out, going for my one run a day, whereas you guys are actually going into work and doing things to kind of fight this this virus and this crisis. I wanted to start off with kind of not getting right into the center of the action. So Mustafa, can you tell us a little bit about what it's like in the pharmacy? Are you guys getting inundated with requests? What's happening on the front lines for you?
So I think it's calmed down slightly in the community pharmacy sector compared to 2 weeks ago when the original lockdown was just before the lockdown was announced, where people were coming into the pharmacy as if the world was ending, stockpiling on paracetamol, stockpiling on soap, on everything under the sun you can think of. People were coming in and requesting. You had asthmatics and diabetics coming in and requesting 3 month supplies of their medications out of fear that they're going to be locked down and they're not going to be able to get supplies of their medication. And that was the original shock of it, was the sheer amount of footfall or people coming into the pharmacy that we were trying to cope with. But I think over the past couple of weeks, as more and more guidelines have come out, as companies and pharmacies have started to catch up, the flow has started to steady, and it has calmed down a little bit in terms of the amount of people coming out, the amount of people coming to the pharmacy.
Were you guys prepared in advance for this, in terms of stockpiling or anything, or?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So we're out of, for example, we're out of a very common inhaler. With asthmatics, they tend to take two inhalers. They take their regular blue inhaler, which is known as the reliever. So they take it there and then when they feel short of breath. But they take another inhaler, which is usually a brown colored inhaler, which is a steroid inhaler, which is the preventer, which is the thing that they which is the medicine that they take regularly to prevent, to prevent them getting asthma attacks and to keep their asthma under control. So with those types of inhalers, the preventers, the steroid inhalers, we're completely out of stock for them, for example.
So there's things off luck now that are unavailable. Now, you guys supply only to the front line, right? Do you guys supply to hospitals as well, or is that a different?
No. So with community pharmacy, we supply to the general public. Hospitals, they probably have multi-million pound contracts with the manufacturers or with general medicine suppliers. So what we're being told is that there isn't a problem per se in the ingredients or in the medicines. It's just that demand is just outstripping supply. They just can't get it to us quick enough.
Because so many people are buying it on the ground.
Yeah. So I got a, on Thursday, for example, we got about 20, we got an order about 20 of one type of inhaler, and that was gone within an hour because we had, a backlog of inhalers that we didn't give to people. So within an hour, we'd given out all these types of inhalers,
and then you've got a shortage again,
and we're back to zero. So the trend we're seeing in terms of the supply chain is that there isn't really a shortage of medication, but it's just that the supply just can't keep up with the demand.
Okay,
and it's because a lot of sort of doctors are all transitioning from paper prescriptions to electronic prescriptions to prevent the face-to-face contact and to prevent contact with the patients. We're seeing a massive surge in the prescriptions coming into the pharmacy. And obviously, with your staff getting sick, with all of the other factors that maybe we'll touch on later on, it's proving difficult to keep up.
Are you using, I'll get to that, but to switch to the doctor where you said about prescription, so we have an anaesthetist. I know probably you're not actually doing most of the prescribing because that would be a GP, but have you experienced anything in terms of more patients are kind of being prescribed lots of drugs? Are doctors going a little bit prescription crazy or prescription happy? I don't know how that goes. And have you experienced a shortage in the hospital even of certain drugs?
Assalamualaikum. I'm not quite sure on the people, a general practitioner is prescribing more. I don't think
because I assume you don't prescribe many drugs directly to patients, right?
Yeah. So we don't really do prescription or take home medication. I mean, I myself am an asthmatic and had recently moved to a new house and had some work done, and the dust has triggered my asthma. And this was all just within the last 2 weeks. So from my own experience, I knew that I know that, for example, getting hold of a general practitioner was difficult. The decision to then prescribe me medication without seeing me or assessing me was very difficult for the GP, but obviously he had to do that. He trusted that I knew what I was talking about to be able to prescribe me the medications that I needed. To then get to that medication was another mission. It was long queues, long waits. So I can understand it from a patient perspective. From a healthcare professional perspective, again, I can't really comment on overprescribing, overzealous prescribing. Generally, actually, I found the GP that I spoke to was quite cautious. He prescribed what he thought was appropriate.
No, I think in defense of the GPs, because we're in constant contact with them, and they've been doing a great job. I mean, in defense of GPs, and to make it a bit clearer, the GPs have been very, very good with the prescribing, specifically in the area that I work. In the borough that I work in, the GPs have been very, very good with prescribing, not prescribing. So normal prescribing practices, they prescribe on a monthly rolling basis or on a 2 monthly rolling basis, depending on how stable the patient is on their medication. So the GPs have been very, very good in terms of only prescribing to the patients what they need. For example, patients realizing that, oh, I've run out and coming in very last minute to get their prescriptions. GPs have been very, very good with prescribing. It's just the fact that it's trying to get the supplies into the pharmacy that's proving difficult.
So I guess that's...
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Sorry,
I think that's, you're right. I think even me as an example, I mean, obviously I think I had a particular trigger to why I needed it, but I just so happened to need a particular drug that I should have really been renewing my prescription and I should have really been seeing my GP about when times were normal, but I didn't. So I can imagine that there's a lot of other people with similar comorbidities that all of a sudden realize that they're about to run out of X drug and panic and buy it. There's also obviously the concept, the idea that a lot of our vulnerable are being shielded for 3 months. So there must be a pressure to be able to prescribe and deliver three months' worth of drugs to certain people, which again just drains supply. But just to go back on the point about hospital medicine, which I and especially anesthetics and intensive care, yes, there are shortages. There are shortages in some of the drugs that we use for sedation, which was what we need to do for patients that we then ventilate. In my own trust, we have had shortages of something called Diamorph, which we don't really use that much for intensive care, but obviously we use in obstetrics for forming epidurals and stuff. So we're then needing to use other drugs, which then can then drain the supplies for other departments in the hospital, like intensive care. And that is something that unfortunately is going to happen. The drugs that, like I said, that we use for sedation and intubation.
What's the alternative?
Are going to slowly run out.
So what's the alternative if as a doctor, you don't have medication available that's necessary to treat patients that are in front of you?
And that's a very, very difficult question. I think it's the same ethical issue or dilemma that you face and that you've heard about in terms of, you know, lack of ventilators. Is what do you then do? And the idea is obviously we have to make sure that we use what's appropriate when it's appropriate. We are very mindful with regards to waste. So normally, for example, some drugs come in ampules that are of X volume and you only really need a very small amount of that. A normal protocol would be that you then dispose of that entire ampule because it's supposed to be single patient use. But there will be things in place where you can then use the same ampule for different patients, just making sure that the process of withdrawing that drug is sterile, etc.
But we're not quite there yet.
No. And also just not to panic people. I mean, the thing with anaesthetics is, as anaesthetists will always tell you, that the process of giving an anaesthetic is an art. There are different cocktails of drugs that are available. We've got recipes that a lot of anaesthetists, like 99% of anaesthetists, use, things like propofol, fentanyl, midazolam, etc. But there are other drugs available, and people probably just have to practice outside what they normally do, and use different cocktails just to make sure that we're managing supply.
Okay. I think coming to the ICU side of it, so Kamal, you've had a number of years, I think 15 plus years of experience working on ICUs, and you're kind of responsible for the management side of it as well. Have you seen anything this unprecedented before in your experience working, and how do you see kind of this, like kind of the preparation for this? Do you think it's adequate? Do you think we're in the thick of it yet, or is it yet to get worse?
Yeah, so what happening actually, my colleagues know the patient come in intensive care unit when is the last resort of need a elective ventilation. So at the moment, the drugs, we have no problem because we have enough drugs to use, like propofol, alfentanil, and midazolam, and some of the patient is on muscle relaxant. We use cesaticurium and ritucurium. And the guidelines and dealing with this patient with the respiratory problems, some of the patient just been tubed and blown on straight away with it, helping their oxygenation and improve ventilation. So from the pharmacy's side of view, we have a pharmacy team who just stock what items we need on a daily basis. And the setup of the mail side and the phone system that you can ring them what stock you need. Because as a COVID, we as an ICU is a complete COVID unit now. So okay. It's not all the people can come into the unit. So it's just been on. We ring them, leave the stock outside, and we put it in the cupboards.
What about PPE? So if you guys are a full COVID unit, a lot of people are reporting there's a shortage of personal protective equipment.
Not actually. We have the PPE equipment we require. The one is an A&E, an infectious diseases ward, and then in the last in ICU. So we have like a silver command and a gold command offices, which they deals on a daily basis. That's what are the requirement of individual wards, so the PPE, for how many you need for per day, or depends on the patient. So we request stock on a daily basis in the morning meetings, that what our requirement, and there we have enough PPE. Because what happened now is most of the wards are closed. There is no elective surgeries. So the staff is coming in to help ICU people. So the number of staffing is going up, and we have to train the staff for when we go on our escalation time, that we need to, you know, look after patient in a theater and a day services. So we have enough PPE, no problem, and it's been replaced on a daily basis. The coordinators who just been on a managing side, they are responsible to restock all the items. All the on-call managers, directors, they're all been in a link and in contact with us. So as soon as we need anything, we just give them a call and they arrange it for us. So it's not a problem.
So asking about
stock for PPE.
Asking about numbers of, for example, ventilators and things like that. And feel free to jump in here from the doctor side or the pharmacist as well. Do you think you have enough capability? Are you guys operating at a high capacity in terms of ventilators? Are you seeing a mix of patients in terms of old and younger? Is it still mostly older people who are the ones who need to be hospitalized?
No, it's all the mixed ages, actually. I know the people were saying that elderly are a bit more affected, but I've seen from age of 30 to 65 or 71. So they all mixed up, and there's mostly the patient with the diabetes and hypertension with underlying health problems and comorbidities. They come in ICU, and they're all on as a level 3 on elective ventilation. So we... Could be as a not my, you know, the Greater Manchester network. So MRI is dealing with the MRI got at the moment 52 patients. So MRI, Salford, within show, and us. So we build up, increase the capacity, and we're planning when they become on the escalation period. So we start using theaters, which we're using now, day services, and the other departments to...
I think it's maybe a bit... It's pretty interesting, Kamal, that you mentioned that you only have about 50 patients. Is that in MRI? In MRI? Or is
MRI.
It, is
MRI. Across,
MRI. Yeah. It's not across the trust.
No, it's not across.
So MRI, which is Manchester Royal Infirmary.
Yes.
Manchester Infirmary.
Okay, so
but so I think that, maybe so just touching on the PPE question here, Carmel said that they seem to be having enough. Maybe I think maybe that's because sort of looking at the statistics and looking at the numbers, the majority of the infections are more focused in the south. In London, I don't know what it's like in the Midlands.
I think the London had a high number of patients as compared to, you know, the Liverpool and Manchester.
Yeah. So I think in London, so I know, for example, in London that the PPE is A, not inadequate, and B, they just can't seem to get enough of it. They can't seem to be supplying in PPE quick enough, because a lot of the PPE that is being supplied in hospitals, I mean, if you've seen the pictures, it's pretty ridiculous. You get a plastic apron. I mean, that's what they've sent us in the pharmacy. We get plastic aprons, which look like bin liners. We have surgical masks that technically we should be disposing of after we use maybe once, or we're meant to be changing them daily, and we're getting some latex gloves. And obviously, in a team of 6 or 7 or 8 people in a pharmacy, one box of latex gloves will probably finish in no time. So it's just the quality of the PPE that's been
there's been some rumors as well of expired PPE being provided. I don't know if there's any truth to these.
Oh no, definitely. It's definitely truth. The masks that we received in the pharmacy were all expired. They'd stuck. So the masks, the box of masks, had expired in 2016 and 2012 or something like that. But they've simply just stuck a sticker on top of it saying 2021. I mean, we raised it with our sort of the superintendents and the clinical superiors we have in the company that I work for. And what we were told was that these masks, they're graded for surgery, so for use in a surgical setting in an operating theater maybe. And for use in that setting, the expiry date is 2016 or 2012 or whatever it is. But for what we're using it for, just in the community or in the pharmacy, they're in fact graded for much longer. Right. I don't know.
Maybe it's not. Have any of the other two experienced something like that in terms of PPE that was inadequate or clearly wrong that you had to use?
Yeah, I mean, if I can just say something, there are several issues I have found with the issue of PPE. Number one, I haven't been in a situation where I needed an item of PPE and haven't been able to find it, which is reassuring. There's an issue of like the expiry dates that's been recognised. I think with that issue, number one, we all know that best before dates on anything aren't really always that accurate. So that can also be a factor of play. I don't really understand how certain items expire. I don't know whether or not there's any bio layers or anything in particular within the materials that biodegrades over time, which makes them ineffective, and that's probably the case. But people have been, you know, you do get stickers on top of the expiry dates to say a newer expiry date, which is a bit dubious. And like you said, obviously, it's been escalated, and we seek the advice of our seniors. And it's always been, you know, explained to us in a way that it is plausible and can make sense. The one thing that I'm seeing, which I think has been extremely frustrating, is the changing in the guidelines with regards to personal protective equipment. So initially it was said that you only need to wear you only need to wear a certain mask if you are encountering a certain type of patient. So for example, you only need to wear a surgical mask if you're dealing with suspected patients, and there's very low risk of them, you know, coughing all over you or splattering all over you, or if you're not really getting into their personal space to do any intimate examinations or take samples. And then the rules then somehow changed, but no, you need to wear a specific medical type of respirator masks, which is a funky type of mask that you've seen people wear that essentially filters the breath as you breathe in and out. And then the rules changed back to like, no, actually, all you need to wear is that mask. And then again, the same issue with regards to wearing a visor or eye protection. Initially, it was told that if you're dealing with any patients who are suspected COVID, you wear this, 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 that. And then all of a sudden you go into work and you're like, oh no, you only need to wear this visor or eye protection if you're doing this, this and that, or if the patient is confirmed or if you're working in certain areas. And then again, 2 days later, you go back and you see that the guidelines have again changed. And that's the same, I think, across the board, across all the different trusts, things are changing, and it makes you worry that one day where, you know, using X precautions And then the next day, we're either getting new evidence or we're realizing that we're running out of stock, or we're getting stock and the guidelines change again. And I think that's what's really unnerving and really getting under the skin of healthcare professionals, is the inconsistency on what PPE is required. Simple things like, you know, there's this concept of aerosol generating procedures, which in simple terms, basically procedures which just help get, or which will essentially mobilize virus particles from your chest into the air. And there are certain things that you've always been told are aerosol generating. So things like coughing, for example, is quite a common one that everyone thinks or understands to be aerosol generating. When this first started, we were given a particular list of things that were considered to be aerosol generating. And if you are doing, or in the vicinity of anyone who's having this type of treatment, then you need to be wearing a specific type of mask that has to be done in a particular location. Many of them, for example, can't be done in A&E. We were told at one point that we can't give any nebulized medications. And then slowly, the laws change, and all of a sudden, the guidelines change. So, and all of a sudden, things aren't aerosol generating. Coughing isn't aerosol generating. And it just makes you think, are these rules being changed because within the 2 weeks or 3 weeks that, you know, this has been around in the UK?
So coughing isn't...
Or within a couple of months in the world, the research has changed and has shown that you don't need it. Or are the rules being changed because we don't have enough equipment? And the fact that a lot of healthcare professionals feel that we can't get an honest answer. If they told us, look, we haven't got the equipment, and yes, there is a risk, try as much as you can, but this is all we've got available for you, then perhaps the attitude of healthcare professionals will be very different. It's just the fact that we feel like constantly the wool is being pulled over our eyes. We're being falsely reassured. We're seeing our healthcare professionals get sick. We're seeing relatives of healthcare professionals die because, you know, no one knows, but are they taking this disease back home and then infecting healthcare professionals? It's just making everyone really unnerving. And that's just one thing I'll say about the whole PPE issue.
So I guess that question about coughing not being a aerosol, coughing as in like when someone coughs, wouldn't that be a direct indicator that they're a COVID suspect? So how do you know if someone's a COVID suspect or not?
So as this has progressed over the last couple of weeks, the criteria for suspecting COVID has changed. Initially, it was, you know, return travellers with flu-like symptoms or with coughs. And then all of a sudden, being a return traveller was no longer an indication, because we now know that the disease, we have a residue of the disease in the country, so it's no longer important. And then again, it was just, you know, a fever, a cough were indications. And then slowly, it's got to the point now where actually almost everyone is treated as a query COVID patient until proven otherwise. So you obviously have much higher clinical suspicion if people think, if patients have presented complaints that include like a temperature and just a general symptoms that you generally get with COVID that everyone's aware of: dry cough, lethargy, muscle ache, sore throat, bowel upset. So all of those different symptoms can also be used to help you confirm or put COVID as a higher up of your differentials when you're managing these patients.
But I think that the disparity in symptoms, or the lack of clarity in symptoms, is filtering down to the community as well, because I'm still seeing people who come into the pharmacy who are coughing. They'll come into the pharmacy, and obviously you don't want to, you want to be professional. You want to treat the patient. You want to treat the patient right, and you want to give them the service that they expect. But you also have to worry about yourself, and you worry about your team. Now, I've already got two people in my team, for example, who are self isolating for 2 weeks, who are either scared because they've got at risk family members, or they themselves have started to develop symptoms. But certainly the disparity and the lack of clarity that is coming out from whoever it is that's making these decisions is filtering down to.
I mean, even the isolation is a little bit of a. Is it 7 days for a single person, and then 14 days?
So if you start to develop symptoms yourself, it's 7 days, until theoretically the symptom, your body fights off the infection and the symptoms start to clear. If it's someone in your family who has the symptoms, or someone that you live close to, or you work you work in very close proximity to starts to develop symptoms, then you need to isolate for 14 days because there's an incubation period for where the virus is in your body, but it's not really active. You're asymptomatic. You're not showing any symptoms. And it's within that period where you could be infecting other people without you realizing. So it's 14 days if that's the case, but it's 7 days if you are showing symptoms, which is even a bit confusing even for me. I only managed to understand it or get it a few days ago. But you can imagine if healthcare professionals and pharmacists and doctors and nurses are having a bit of confusion with all of this stuff, how are we expecting the members of the public and the general public to take this on? And I think that's been one of the biggest criticisms of towards the government, towards Public Health England, and all of that since the crisis started.
Kamila, I had another question for you from an ICU perspective, which is there's patients who are getting admitted in. At what point do you consider a patient severe enough for them to be admitted in? And within your hospital, I think you've still got an A&E where basically patients come in. Patients who come in, are they still suspected of having potentially COVID-19 positive?
Yeah, so patient come in any with the respiratory problems, pneumonia or coughing and all these symptoms which they've been a guidelines, they've been suspected COVID. So what they do, they are going to do blood gases and they check their situation and everything. And they refer to the ICU team. So ICU team refer to those patients. And if they are they start giving a treatment to try to keep stabilized in the ward and then look at their underlying health conditions. So if they become hypoxic, their saturation drops, their PO2 level start dropping and unable to breathe, difficulty breathing and hemodynamically getting stable. So these patients, there is an anesthetic team in North Manchester. So what they do, they take them to theater, intubate, sedated and paralyzed, stabilize, put all these invasive lines in, and they bring into ICU. So it's been the ICU team then review these patients, infectious diseases team review these patients, and then they call the anesthetist. So because we're full now in ICU, but before we have an aside room where this suspected patient come into the side room, intubated and electrically ventilated till we get the results back positive. So once they are positive, they've been out into the COVID unit. If they are negative, then we shift out to the theater and then transfer out as a non-COVID patient. So what we're doing, actually, we're swabbing these patients twice. For example, if the one swab comes negative, then we swab it again to double check whether they are definitely negative or they are definitely positive patients.
That brings a question about the COVID kind of tests, right? So there's been a big discussion on this that UK elected not to do mass tests. What exactly do these tests look like? What do they involve? And also, what's the holdup of us all getting tested? Like, is it really expensive? Is it a different type of test? Or
for the patient, when they come, in A&E or infectious diseases wards, they take a nose and throat swab.
Okay.
For the COVID. But once they've been intubated on elective ventilation and they come in ICU, so we send as a second swab, nose and throat swab plus tracheal aspirates together, so to just double check whether they are definitely confirmed positive to being shift them out in the rest of the COVID patient. But the rest of the routine setup, they do like a pneumococcal, legionella antigen, blood cultures, and all routine investigation. So because sometimes this patient is mostly been admitted with the multi-organ failure, they go on dialysis, so we do all these blood-borne viruses and everything. But the test for the COVID, nasal and throat swab, and a tracheal aspirate if they're intubated.
Okay, so I guess it sounds like it seems a bit more invasive because it's all the way into like a tracheal swab or something like that. Now, most patients who have COVID aren't actually coming into hospital, right? They're just isolating for 14 days, even if they actually have COVID. Is there any prospect of something like this being deployed on en masse, like for everyone to be tested? And do you think that would be...
No, what happened? Yeah. So what happening? I've just been, some of my friends, they've been having symptoms and in the community because we have been in contact with the friends and family. So they've been looked after, they have been in contact with the GP, they get an advice for this 1111. And when they start having the symptoms, you go to the A&E, they're doing a chest x-ray. When they start getting a bit, little bit worse, then they do a test. So one of my friend's child get COVID, is positive, and is recovered now. So it's better.
Okay. But there's a way to add something. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Just on the question of tests. So there's different types of tests that you can do to try and identify. You probably would have all heard the health secretary, the chief science officer, talking about antigen and antibody tests. So the antigen is the actual virus, and you can test to see whether or not someone's actively infected. There are loads of different tests that are being developed or that have been developed by, like, for example, Germany have a specific test that they manufacture, as well as China. And the different tests have different have different sensitivity, the ability to actually pick up the virus antigen. There's loads of different steps that are involved in actually having a success and performing a successful test. So it's not really just a matter of having a swab and then putting it in a particular solution that then changes colour if there's COVID in there. There's loads of reagents, there's loads of different parts of machinery and equipment that are needed. And I think the issue with the testing is, like, there's so many different factors that you need to be able to do a successful test. It's been quite difficult to get them all or source them all to be able to mass test, basically. That's the problem. So when this first broke out, anyone who came in with symptoms, this was weeks ago now, perhaps even months ago, we were swabbing them and we were sending them home, and then they'll be called by Public Health England with the outcome of their tests. I think it probably, this wasn't obviously ever said, but I think it was probably realised very quickly that we don't have enough capability to do that and test sick people. So the testing strategy has now changed, whereby everyone who gets unwell is suspected to have COVID and is told to stay at home, and hopefully 80% of them will recover on their own. But then the tests have been reserved for the people who actually do need to be admitted into hospital. So it's only if you need to be admitted into hospital do you get tested. At the moment, even if you rock up to A&E with very mild, with symptoms that obviously you think are horrendous, but when a clinician assesses you, they're only mild and they're happy for you to go home, you almost certainly won't get tested. There's another test that most, I think, healthcare professionals more than anything really want, which is the antibody test. So after your body is exposed to the virus, the way that it then it activates the immune system is by the generation of something called antibody, which is essentially like a little tag that circulates in your blood, and it identifies these COVID cells for your white cell counts to then come and destroy them. That's essentially what an antibody is. It's just circulating in your blood. There are hopefully going to be they do exist. I only this morning was forwarded a message by someone on Instagram who's been selling them online, where they most probably rely on a blood sample, I think, and where they'll be able to pick up whether or not you've got the antibody, which will then hopefully indicate that you've had the virus and your body's kind of created some sort of immunity against it, so therefore maybe be a little bit less paranoid.
Are these sold tests through official channels, or are they like someone on eBay has just made something up? And
no, so this is some guy on Instagram who I saw today who's doing it. I think several private clinics are doing the tests privately, which is obviously a little bit more official. But the guy quotes to have the exact same test that they're doing privately, and he's selling the packs. The thing is with all of these tests, what an which entrepreneur. Is like what the Say that again.
So that's just basically a smart entrepreneur trying to make money out of it. It could be a fake, but it could be legit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the kits he's got are probably legit. The question is, which, again, if anyone's listened to the chief science officer and speak on the, or chief medical officer, sorry, speak on the issue, is you need a test that works the best. So you need a test that's able to pick up COVID antigens in the majority of patients. At the moment, the test that we're using in the majority of hospitals in the UK has the ability to only detect about 63 to 70% of positive patients. That means 30% or more of patients who do have COVID come back with a negative result. So the consequences are deadly.
As with everything, there has to be an error margin. Nothing's 100%.
Yeah, but we probably need more like upper 90s rather than 60%.
Yeah, but then what the argument we can pose here is that this is maybe it's a new virus. the tests that are coming out are still maybe, I wouldn't really say they're in their experimental phase, but because obviously they are being used. But the fact that the virus itself is still very, it's still very new, relatively new compared to all the other viruses that are out there. So I think
as time
goes on, maybe the error margin will decrease once they can formulate or find a way of testing that is more accurate.
Yeah, you're right. Because when we, like in ICU point of view, when we started, is all, you know, we don't know every hour guidelines change, every hour to hour management change. Now it looks like everything is settling now, is settled. We know what we're doing, what the protocol is, what the guidelines and the criteria is. So we feel much comfortable to dealing with the patient now. Like few weeks ago is a problem. You know, every hour, 2 hours, they say, oh, don't do this, where the category best will go, where you get don and doffing, you know, wearing all this PPE on. So it's much settled now because people know what they're doing.
Okay, sorry, what were you saying, doctor, about the issue with this testing?
Sorry, no, what I was saying was essentially the false negatives are the biggest problem. And I think that's why we haven't had a test that is appropriate to use. We don't have the quantities, and also a test that is safe enough to use for the masses.
Yeah,
and then that creates loads of problems, even within healthcare, even within hospitals. You know, what do you do with a patient who's clearly clinically COVID, but comes back with a negative swab? And some hospitals are moving patients, those said patients, to normal wards, non-COVID wards. That really shouldn't be the protocol. The protocol should be that you get tested, and tested, like in some London hospitals, where you have to have a third negative test to then be, you know, de-escalated from a COVID ward. But some hospitals are basing that on just one test. That patient then goes onto a non-COVID ward with other vulnerable patients who had probably been in hospital long before COVID broke out. And there's a risk that they are then actually COVID positive and are spreading it. And that has happened in hospitals. So, you know, there are issues with the test. There are issues what we do with the results of these tests. And again, it's not universal. It's not across the board in terms of the strategy that we have to dealing with that.
Is there anything on immunity that any of you have seen, that in terms of if you get the virus, are you still likely to get it again, or is there a reduced chance in this whole thing?
So if you're immune to the virus, you are immune to that particular strand of the virus. Correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, but I would say forever. I could be wrong, but if you're immune to a particular strain of the virus, you are immune to it. But the very nature of viruses is that they continuously evolve and change in some cases very, very quickly. That's why every single year we have a flu vaccine, because that's a different strain of the flu every single year. And I think that's the worry. I mean, I don't know if the doctor or Camille want to add anything to that, but
yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're immune to that strain. There have been, I don't know whether or not any of you guys have been looking into any of the research papers that have been coming out for this, but there was some concern again a couple of weeks ago about people being reinfected with COVID after they seemingly get better a couple of weeks later, they then get affected again. That's still something that's people are looking into that ongoing. There was also this other concern about patients appearing to be getting over the disease and then they have another positive test. I think a lot of that's been put down to faulty tests and also just the way that the virus operates within the human body. Mm. But I think, and I hope that this is correct, that if you get COVID this year, inshallah, you are immune to it, at least until the next strain comes out. And considering how horrendously savage this strain is, you do worry about what does the future hold. A simple mutation can change it from being just a very small local infection that you can control to something that's caused havoc across the whole world.
Yeah, global pandemic.
I guess moving to kind of closing remarks, and we'll start with you, Kamal. If you can kind of anything concluding you want to say, but also in particular what you would say to our wider audience in terms of your advice.
Yes, I will tell the one I before, because I'm the one who immunized ICU staff in ICU, and I've got the people after immunization for this flu, people get flu. So even after immunization, I've got antibodies built up, they still get the flu. you know, influenza when they get poorly. So the first thing is that for the wider audience, actually, to be honest, is stay home. And it's very, very difficult to look after a patient in ICU with all PPE on. This FSM 18, FSM 8, 16, and this FP3 mask is very tight mask. It's difficult for the staff to breathe. Your throat get very dry. Your mouth get very dry. You're thirsty. You're having this PPE on for 3-4 hours, you know. So you cannot drink. You know, if you're feeling thirsty, you can't do it until you have to have DOF on. So it's very hard. It's very difficult. But hopefully, inshallah, we will go in there. Inshallah, the people get better, get cured, and we can come out of this pandemic, inshallah, if we work together and follow all the guidelines and the safety precautions.
Inshallah, God willing. Okay, thank you very much for that. I don't know if, Doctor, you want to go next or...
Nothing really other than please stay home, stay safe, look after your loved ones. If you've got people that are at risk within your family, just try and get, you know, within your families, trying to find the best strategic way to shield them from possible exposure to this disease. And just keep, you know, just keep asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for his mercy. And obviously we are hopeful and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that the end of this will come as quickly as it started, inshallah. But yeah, just stay safe, take care of your family. I guess in a little bit more of a grim way, a lot of healthcare workers have generally just appreciated that their own mortality is at play. Like the fear of their own mortality is a lot real now. So, you know, things like writing wills, discussing, you know, powers of attorney, discussing escalation plans within your families, really good and important and healthy to have those discussions now before you're suddenly bereaved, like a very dear friend of mine was, and you're left scrambling, trying to piece everything together. So, stay safe.
Yeah, no, jazakallah for that. Just a quick plug that maybe you guys would be interested in. We talked about this last episode as well. Our friends at Islamic Finance Guru are doing a big discount on their Islamic wills for all NHS employees. So it's a pay as you please kind of thing. I mean, it's a very affordable product and something worth it anyway, but this is something for NHS employees that you guys might be interested in as well.
Yeah, it's a good time to make a will because of the COVID around.
It's something we should always have. I mean, we're not trying to panic monger and say that we're all going to die, but ultimately at some point we are, and it's best to be prepared as soon as possible rather than later and regret it.
Definitely.
Mustafa, over to you.
I think just echo the sentiments of the doctor and Kamil. Just stay at home. If you have a cough, please don't go out. The amount of people that have come into the pharmacy over the past 2 weeks with a cough, obviously we try our best to treat and help, but please stay at home. Please take the guidance and the advice seriously. It is for our own good, and hopefully, you know, this is lifted soon. We are in the middle of a global pandemic, and we need to sort of bond together as communities and as society to overcome this. And to all the young people out there, if you have elderly neighbors, if you've got elderly relatives or elderly people in the community, be that service for them. Go out, help them. Go to the pharmacy for them. Go shopping for them. I know there are a lot of organizations out there who have their own initiatives. Maybe just have a look at any local charity or any local initiative and try to join them.
I believe the NHS has a national one as well, which again, part of it involves going out, but part of it is actually you can just chat to people on the phone that you can download. It's on a goodsamapp.org/NHS. So that could be potentially definitely something.
Yeah, that's that. I mean, it is, again, not to sound too grim, but we haven't reached the peak yet. The peak is due within a week or two. But hopefully, if we do carry on following the guidance that we have and everyone does their part, you know, we won't feel it as much as other countries maybe have felt it. But just definitely stay at home. Stay at home and everyone do your part.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Obviously, really appreciate you guys taking the time out for this, but also all the work that you guys are doing on the front lines. I know that Kamil was working all night, so he just got back at 9 a.m. And I know that the doctor also is going back to work on night. So you guys are really kind of on the front lines, working long shifts. Most of you are probably spending time stacking up meds and making sure the practice is ready. The pharmacy is ready for the busy shift. So really, thank you very much to you all. Jazakumullah khair. May Allah reward you for all your efforts. And hopefully we'll be able to do a bit more. I know today was very technical. Really appreciate you guys sharing your knowledge. We'll try and do a little bit of a dissection on possibly some of these points as the things develop on the podcast. As always, you can follow us on the Middle West PC and Middle West Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can email us at podcast@themiddlewest.co.uk. And you can reach out to us with your suggestions, any further guest ideas, or your thoughts on how the podcast went. I'd like to say once again, thank you very much to my guests. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay.
Wa alaikum assalam.